I am here with Susan Orlean, who is most recently the author of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Susan, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm great. I'm excited and I'm happy and I'm relieved. There's nothing quite like having a book actually done to put you in a good mood, to lighten your step.
Oh, what puts you in a bad mood in relation to books?
Having a deadline hanging over me for 10 years. That put me kind of in a bad mood.
Yeah, okay. I wanted to first of all start off with something rather unusual. I had found this accidentally because I started to read Finnegan's Wake like a month ago. I'm now on page 20. But on page 12, I was very happy to find this. There is this passage. She knows her knight's duty while Luntum sleeps. Did ye save any tin, says he. Now, this comes after Joyce has laid down all sorts of Germanic references. And, of course, while London sleeps, Rin Tin Tin film.
Right.
So this seems as good a pretext as any to ask, well, if Rin Tin Tin got the approval of James Joyce, what accounts for his appeal? What accounts for this enduring popularity? What is the ultimate quality of Mr. Rinty here?
You know, that, I think in a way, the fact that you can't quite answer that is the answer. That there is, there's a kind of charisma that certainly the first Rin Tin Tin had, but also the symbol of a dog, which is a dog who is brave and true and loyal and heroic, is, and that resonates with people. He embodied it, especially the first Rin Tin Tin, so well that I think it kind of touched something that was already there. Mm-hmm. The desire to have a superhero who was credible and not some comic book figure, but actually something real.
Crypto before crypto.
Yeah.
A super dog to match the Superman.
Exactly. I also think that if you could say what it is that makes something endure, you've ruined it in a way, that there is something mysterious and wonderful about something that connects with so many people and that lasts for so long that shouldn't be something that you could put in words.
Yeah.
I think that it defines itself by being something emotional that you feel and that you respond to that can't quite be described.
Well, I wanted to point out something that you mentioned in the book. You point out that in the 19th century, dogs had only been recently domesticated. They were considered to have deeper feelings. They were capable of expressing their emotions more than humans. Now, I should point out that Jack London's The Call of the Wild and White Fang, well, this is only 15 years before the first Rin Tin Tin film. I'm wondering, how did World War I, I suppose, tilt this fixation from dogs as emotional beings to this heroic quality that we're talking about? Was hero worship the next inevitable stage in the evolution of this man-dog perception situation? Or?
Well, for one thing, there were so many dogs in the war. People in World War I saw dogs performing heroically.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of a battlefield and dogs being brave and being companionable and working hard, which they did, and maybe not showing as much fear as a soldier might.
Yeah.
Because dogs don't have the apprehension of death and the, you know, worry of mortality the way people do. So they have the chance to be brave in a way people can't. So there's no question that seeing dogs and being alongside dogs in the war had a very huge impact on their perception. I mean, there were tens of thousands of dogs in World War I.
Yeah.
So I imagine this entire generation of soldiers coming back filled with awe. It was also a time where dogs were working not as our servants, the way they might have on a farm or a ranch, but as equals, pretty much. I mean, dogs were in the trenches with soldiers.
Yes.
So the feeling that they were our partners almost more than our possessions arose during that time.
Well, you mentioned this move towards the cities that is still ongoing even in our time. It's interesting to me that we went from dogs being perceived as, well, let's figure out what happens when they're domesticated, when they come from the wild, and vice versa, those two Jack London novels. And then you have this situation where suddenly they're fighting wars with us.
Right.
I'm wondering what it is about that turns a dog into a hero, as opposed to some sort of, like, emotional beast or some sort of tapping into some primordial instinct or whatnot. I mean, do you think that the original folks, Lee Duncan and company, really sort of knew that they had to push the dog thing further? Or
I think what Lee did was totally instinctual. I don't think he was somebody who did a lot of strategizing and projecting forward what would be good.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that's part of what's so touching about him, is he seemed to be somebody who was really responding entirely out of this feeling of, I have this wonderful dog and I want you to appreciate how wonderful he is, rather than, I can make some money off of this if we write scripts that make him such and so.
Yeah.
Remember, too, that people consumed entertainment in an entirely different way.
Sure.
In the 20s. It wasn't the juggernaut that it is today, that if you come up with a good character, you can then merchandise it and, you know, turn it into a multi-platform marketing device. It wasn't like that. I think it was,
yeah,
a simpler thing. How the idea of the heroic character evolved is, first of all, animals have very often appeared in, you know, in early literature.
Sure.
As having heroic qualities that were selfless. I think selflessness is something that an animal can have more easily than a person.
Or it's more easy to understand altruism when it's placed within an animal as opposed
exactly.
to a man.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it may seem a little funny to us now, but when you look at an animal doing something heroic, you don't project a million things onto it. You don't think, oh, he reminds me of my Uncle Milton, who I don't like that much, or, oh, I'm sick of, you know, this type of person always being the hero, or
yeah,
he's or she isn't my race or gender or color, whatever.
Yeah.
A dog is something else.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at it and admire it and maybe be in awe of it without bringing a lot of your own baggage to it. It's not a person.
Yeah.
You know, you don't look at it with the critical eye that you might look at a person with. So there's a way that it's easier to be thrilled by them and not have that reserve of thinking, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, in those films, all the people, the early Rin Tin Tin films, the people are all so flawed. They all are so, each one of them has some, you know, terrible character flaw. Even the heroes among the humans have some, you know, they're either naive or they're, you know, they all fail. And
yeah,
whether that's some aftermath of the war in which people saw what terrible things people could do to each other, that feeling that human beings were deeply flawed, maybe that's what made a dog a hero that could be admired more freely and,
yeah,
and with less reservation.
Well, to jump back to your earlier point about this being a different way of thinking about animals and thinking about art, I mean, we're dealing with a war in which soldiers are reading poetry, writing poetry, philosophy, and the like, and yet here we have perhaps the ultimate mass cultural medium, sort of equivalent to what video games are now, being used to create this new heroic image of a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, do you have any theories as to why the war and that sort of being in the trenches thinking about poetry and philosophy led to the sort of more mass cultural approach? Did it really sort of take a kind of a post-war, post-Great War mentality with which to start considering dogs as heroic like this, or...?
That's a tough question. I think that the world was really being reinvented,
yeah,
after World War One,
yeah,
and I think, you know, when you add up the fact of this generation of men coming back from the war with the timing of the move into cities,
yes,
a huge change. I mean, culture I think culture was changing so rapidly, so dramatically at that time, that you see the rise then of a whole bunch of new ideas of what's valuable, what's important. Animals had this connection to our past that was very emotional.
Yes.
So I think as we were seeing our past sort of disappear, you know, say you're a farm boy who goes to World War I, suddenly it's like you don't ever look at the world the same way again, plus you come back and you move to a city for a job, so your whole world has changed.
Sure.
And one component of it that seems steadfast is this companion creature that seems to never change in this world that's changing so dramatically.
Let's shift a few decades forward in the 20th century. Producer Burt Leonard, interesting figure. He made these desperate efforts to revive Rin Tin Tin in the last several years of his life. You also describe Paul Klein, this guy who pretended to be former child actor Lee Aker at various conventions. You, Susan Orlean, personally delivered a puppy with a Rin Tin Tin pedigree to Boston in the 21st century. So I'm wondering, is there some specific quality about Rin Tin Tin that leads to such obsessive, one might almost say defensive behavior? The fact that he's a dog that we all want to believe in, is Rin T some sort of blank slate to have the sort of American obsession writ large? What of this?
I think it's a huge combination of things. And the fact of the idea of something, some character, lasting through such a range of history and social change and culture, I mean, it's astonishing. It really is. I don't think you can look at a single other character and say that single character cut through this much social landscape.
Yeah.
What is it about him? First of all, it's the pure luck of having resonated with people like Lee, like Bert, who were dug in with this determination that this character would last.
Yes.
You know, it could have really ended in the 40s.
Yeah.
It really could have. I mean, that was a moment where he could have been Strongheart. You know,
yeah.
He could have been the dog who had a star, you know, a history in silent film and did some vaudeville and then disappeared.
Sure.
So there's this pure serendipity, the remarkable accident of another generation. But the dog is the blank slate who could have projected on him the dreams of a generation. Now, some of those dreams are the same. The dream of the loyal friend, the protector, the brave companion. I mean, it's a similar dream.
Yeah.
But he evolved from, you know, the character that he was in silent film, which was sort of, he acted kind of on his own. He was, in a way, independent of the people in those films. He was almost more of a godlike character.
Yeah.
Sort of dropped into a situation, helping to sort it out, omniscient.
Mm-hmm.
To the 50s character, where he was the perfect companion. He was always acting as the boy's great companion. And, you know, society had changed. Dogs lived in our homes with us, so we were so much more attuned to the idea of the companion, the true friend.
Yes.
A dog can be that blank slate. I think. So you have the blank slate of Rin Tin Tin. Why that dog and not another dog? Well, that's better scripts and better, and people who fell in love with him, who then directed their lives towards that ultimate goal of, this is a character that should last.
Yeah.
So it's both determined by the appeal that the character had, but then also the good luck of having had the series of people who stepped in and said, this is important. Then these things sort of self perpetuate.
Sure.
I mean, I wouldn't have written a book about a character who didn't last. So in my own way, I'm helping make him last again. So Bert got interested in doing the TV show because the character had lasted from the 20s into the, you know, late 40s. And so the more something lasts, the more it's going to be carried forward, because I think part of us is just so amazed at the idea of anything lasting that it then becomes a self-defining quality. I have endured, therefore I'm special and deserve to endure.
Yeah, but different iterations create different Rinties, and nothing lasts forever. I mean, the stuff with Pat Robertson near the end, I was feeling
weird.
Yeah, I was feeling so sorry for Rinty and many of the other people. So I'm wondering if Rinty has a half-life, a limit of some sort. I mean, or is he very much alive based off of the continued obsessions of his present champions?
Yeah, well, I would like to think that he will last forever, or at least that we've sort of boosted him on in a way, because it's a story. It's a story that's wonderful to tell, and part of the story is about the telling of a story that gets repeated and repeated. So in a way, it has the endless life of a folk tale.
Yes.
And I think that's where you get back to it. Will the character be in movies forever? Who knows? Is the story of this dog who kind of accidentally became an icon, it's a wonderful story, and
sure,
it's a story that'll keep telling. Do we still have the capacity to look at dogs as heroic? I think that's changed. I think people love dogs. There's ample evidence of our devotion to dogs. And, you know, we have dogs by the bucket load. You know, the number of dogs that are kept as pets is astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
And our desire for them just grows and grows. And I never see that going away. So I think there will always be a certain kind of connection to this story, whether it really is as a Hollywood production or whether it's more an appreciation of the idea of this heroic dog.
But Rin Tin Tin, as we find out, does have his opponents, and I have to go ahead and bring some of these up. In 1955, you describe a tense photo shoot, Rin Tin Tin and Lassie appearing on the cover of TV Guide. Now, given how these two dogs were in serious competition with each other, I mean, as you write, Lee paid even more attention to any challenge by Lassie. Were you able to uncover any writers, agreements, provisos, terms, anything, conditions that either the Lassie camp or the Rin Tin Tin camp had agreed upon to make such a meeting of the dogs happen? It was sort of glossed over a little bit, but this seems to me a very high point of pop cultural drama.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it'd be like Rolling Stone having the Beatles and the Rolling Stones together on a cover.
Yes.
Although in this case, it was even really more explicitly a rivalry.
Yeah.
I am amazed that they did it, because Lee, in spite of the fact that I think in general he was an extremely genial person, not argumentative or combative in any way, he was very sensitive about the whole Lassie issue.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they managed to do it. It may have just been that the cover of TV Guide was so significant, and actually Rin Tin Tin had been on the cover alone.
Yeah.
Another time.
Yes.
So it may have been that they felt that we've had the cover ourselves, will agree to do it with Lassie because they have this idea of doing this great story. But it really was sort of a moment in time that would have been fun to be a fly on the wall to see how these arch rivals were kind of coexisting.
Nobody wanted to talk about this. I mean, this is sort of like the Jack Benny Fred Allen rivalry,
right,
you know?
Right. Well, the photo shoot, the story in TV Guide that ran with that photo,
yes,
talked about the tension.
Yeah.
and about how complicated it was to set up the shoot. And Lee never spoke about it except when he was interviewed once and was asked whether some of the same stuntmen appeared on Rin Tin Tin and on Lassie. He was very offended and said, no, you know, our stuntmen are paid to be bitten exclusively by Rin Tin Tin.
I mean, bitten exclusively?
Yes. So he
was that written into the contract? Did you ever able to determine that? Or?
That's really funny.
That'd be a nice little term, bitten exclusively.
I think that they were actually forbidden to work for Lassie, and that, you know, there was this very strong feeling that and as the shows continued, this concern about, you know, their ratings being competitive was only heightened as time went on. And, the stories had some parallels. They were, you know, had this idea of the dog who was heroic and a companion to a little boy. So they did have some parallels.
Sure. You write about Daphne Hereford, who created the Rin Tin Tin Museum and who had to sell off everything on eBay only 2 years after it opened, largely because she had these legal bills relating to battles for the Rin Tin Tin rights. Now, I'm wondering, is there a danger that something like Rinty might be too specialized in interest? Why didn't some of these obsessive defenders anticipate intellectual property law or anything along those lines?
You know, it's amazing how, first of all, when Rin Tin Tin's career began in the 1920s, contracts with movie studios were simple affairs.
Yeah.
You know, it was a sheet or two. It was nothing. And Lee never had an agent. He never used a lawyer. He made deals on his own. But Hollywood was a simpler place then. Burt, representing a whole a different era in Hollywood, certainly had an entire quiver full of lawyers who worked on contracts and so forth. But even so, the idea of intellectual property was still not quite developed at that time. You know, you had a movie, you had a character, but the idea that you had something that existed beyond that was a fairly new idea. It was something that, as Hollywood expanded, as characters appeared in other forms, suddenly it becomes this enormous thing. In the case of Rin Tin Tin, it was even more complicated. Unlike, say, SpongeBob, there is no actual kitchen sponge who exists in the world named SpongeBob. In the case of Rin Tin Tin, there really is a live being, as well as the character, as well as the idea of the character. It was so complex, and I have to say, it still leaves most people quite confused about who owns what.
Although I would imagine it would be ideal relish for lawyers who want to go ahead and define things.
You could probably have an entire practice based on sorting out Rin Tin Tin claims.
But we're also talking about, with Daphne, a recent proponent who is willing to pretty much give up her nest egg in order to preserve what she views as the legacy. And so that is why I'm kind of curious as to why some of the latter champions of Rinty are willing to go ahead to Texas Hold'em, basically.
Mm-hmm. You mean without protecting themselves legally?
Yes, they want to go ahead and put all of their resources into preserving Rinty at all costs from people who they perceive to be, you know, enemies or those who are besmirching the good Rin Tin Tin name and the like. I mean, that particular obsession that comes now in the 21st century, when these figures are aware of these developments in intellectual property. That's what I'm curious.
Yeah, but that's, I think, the nature of passion. Yeah. I think when you really fall in love with something, when you devote your life to it, which is absolutely the case with Lee, with Bert, with Daphne, it's not just, this is my business, this is my job. It was their, and in the case of Daphne, is their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you use the same perspective. I don't think you necessarily build in safeguards. You sort of throw yourself in. That's a lot of what drew me to the story, was the idea that there were people involved who had, in many cases, really sublimated every other interest, every other, and in some cases, logic, self-protection.
Yes.
For this character that just got a hold of them. And as I said, there were times working on the book where I thought, my God, I'm doing the same ridiculous thing. I mean, they're not that you just drop a book and go somewhere and find an easy book to do, but just there was something that made me appreciate what it felt like to be that submerged in an idea and believe in it so much.
Well, to go into that, of Lee Duncan, you declared this was the first time that you had spent so much time learning about one person's life. You write that you felt sometimes that you knew more about Lee than I would have known if I had met him and talked to him and learned about him in the more usual way. Now, it seems to me that perhaps you may have pushed your limits or gone past a certain journalistic threshold in this. Why did Lee capture your sort of curiosity and your need to know everything about him more than any of your other subjects? Was it the constant immersion into boxes in Riverside? What of this?
I felt like, well, first of all, it was the first time I'd written extensively about someone who wasn't alive.
Yeah.
And your access to their innermost thoughts is surprising. I mean, you end up having an intimacy with their lives that you would never dream of, because you don't realize that if somebody has kept some sort of written trail of their life, you're there seeing every bit of it, the bills, their in Bert's case, his ATM slips, everything, things they wouldn't share
ATM
with
you. ATM slips, wow.
Yeah, I know. It was his check statements. Things that wouldn't be shared with you
These
if the person
the
were alive. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so you have, as I began the book, I thought, wow, how am I going to report this? These people are dead, and I'm not used to that. I'm used to writing about people who I can talk to and find out directly from them their thoughts and, see their life. So I was very daunted at first and thought, I don't know, am I going to have anything? And instead I discovered that really I had a deeper, more intimate view into their lives. Would I have liked to have talked to them? Absolutely. But I had a different and probably more detailed record of their lives. And Lee fascinated me. I kept trying to figure out what drove him and what created this bond that was so potent.
How do you respect your subjects when you're dealing with these issues of borderline violation? I mean, they're dead for one thing, so that clears up a lot of problems. But on the other hand, if you're sympathizing with their lives, I mean, how do you deal with that when you're writing about
them? Well, I don't see it as borderline violation. I mean, in the case of Lee, all of his papers are archived, and I don't see a violation. I think it's more an intimate eavesdropping that and also access to things that people might otherwise not think to share with you.
Yeah.
So, because they don't think of it as important, handwritten notes, scraps of paper where they've scribbled stuff.
Sounds like the Facebook timeline.
Well, yeah, in a funny way. Yeah. It really is, you get a kind of glimpse into people's lives that they might not think. I mean, I don't think Lee would have been a very easy interview. I don't think he was a person who would have been able to talk that much about himself.
Yeah.
So I felt like I learned a lot about him through the sort of trail of breadcrumbs that he left behind.
Going back to Daphne, you confess that you suffered her indignation and sense of insult over something I did or a perceived threat to her dominion over Rin Tin Tin. You also write that Daphne sent you a letter that had the statement, "I am Rin Tin Tin," as the last words on the letter. How do you go about cultivating trust with such protective obsessives? I mean, do you tend to also be drawn to these eccentrics by dint of the very subjects that you tend to pursue? it seems to me like it's kind of an occupational hazard, but I am curious about this. I mean, do you kind of know what you're getting into when you delve into a subject like this?
Well,
I mean,
it is an occupational hazard, and people who, I always think of them as people whose lives are writ large. Yeah. Everything is just done in an extreme, and they, of course, become fascinating subjects because of the bigness of their passion, the bigness of their gestures, even the bigness of their perception of themselves. It also means dealing with people who sometimes are impatient with anyone who they don't see as falling, you know, conveniently into what they want to accomplish. And, you know, a perspective that's not always there in terms of the rest of the world. So how do you cultivate trust? You know, it's a... I actually believe that that has to go to a very authentic demonstration on my part of just, I really want to tell the story.
Yeah.
It's not that I am going to say this story exactly as you wish it to be told, but I really want to hear it. I want to hear what it is that you care about. And I do think people, at the end of the day, first of all, respond if they feel that your interest is genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they want to tell their story. They want to be heard, especially if they really love something and care about it. They want that to be told.
But I'm wondering, I mean, obviously, to get people to talk with you, you have to have a genuine curiosity in the subject. On the other hand, if you're steeping yourself so much into Rin Tin Tin, I mean, you probably had Rin Tin Tin overload at some point, I'm gather. Or did you?
Well, I think when you start feeling overloaded, it's time to stop reporting and time to start writing. And I think that that's usually the best sign to you that you've heard, you've reached a point of saturation, you know the story, you're not learning new things anymore, therefore you need to start telling the story.
Yeah.
And I think once I started telling the story, rather than feeling like, oh, I'm just kind of sick of this, I felt more like, oh, there's so much more to learn or so much more background to know, but it's time to tell the story.
Got it. I don't want you to be late for your next thing, so I'll ask you one last question.
Okay.
So the German Shepherd in history. In 1947, there were 4,921 German Shepherds registered with the American Kennel Club. In 1954, that number rises to 17,400. In 1959, 33,735 German Shepherds. The Dogs for Defense, which you bring up, which we talked about a little bit, dogs in war. The Nazis using German Shepherds as dogs. However, Anne Frank also loved Rin Tin Tin. Charles Moore's pictures of 1960s police violence. Obviously, Rin Tin Tin had a huge effect on the perception of German Shepherds for good and for bad. And I'm wondering if we can trace any of these negative developments, such as the ones I have mentioned, to Rin Tin Tin, whether there was any specific message that perhaps was there dormant within the movies or the TV show or anything like that?
Well, I think the only thing that you can look to is that he did represent authority and authority with muscle.
Yeah.
And in many, and certainly in the television show, he was part of the army, you know, the cavalry. So his association was always with law and order.
Yes.
When German Shepherds became very popular with police, you know, in an era where people looked up to the police and felt inspired and impressed by them, the dog means one thing. In an era such as the civil rights demonstrations in the 60s, where police force is viewed far more skeptically, German Shepherds are part of that.
Yeah.
You know, again, the dog is innocent in this, and I think that the perception, I don't think that there is a sort of hidden message of sort of militaristic power.
But now that we're on the subject, we're seeing the rise of Renty along with the rise of fascism at the same time. So,
but you know,
I mean, they're two parallel tracks, but it is interesting.
Yeah, but it is interesting, and I think that all of the, I mean, I found it fascinating. Wrote about it a great deal in the book, yeah, about why was the Nazi Party so enthralled by German Shepherds, and there's a lot of reason for it.
Yeah.
Big strong dogs who have been popular in war and police work will always come to mind if there's some use of that power that people worry about. You don't think, oh my God, golden retrievers, like police dogs.
Yeah.
I mean,
not yet
you,
anyway.
Right. But you know, you make those associations because the fact is those are the dogs that are used both, you know, search and rescue, heroic police work, and, you know, police work that's distressing in some way. So, you know, it's kind of a moving target.
Yeah.
I think German Shepherds are big and strong. I don't think they're inherently fascistic in any way.
Yeah,
And, you know, that just is, it's an image that gets very strongly connected to something. And depending on where you are in the history of time, your connection with that, you know, during World War II, people looked at the army as our saviors and the German Shepherds with the soldiers as part and parcel of the people who are going to keep us from fascism.
Yes.
So it's a, you know, you had two very contrary images meeting literally on the battlefield.
Yes. That's a very good note, and I know your phone is ringing. We're out of time, unfortunately. But Susan, pleasure to chat. We'll have to do this again, definitely. And thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
Picture yourself in a living room. Your pipe and slippers set out for you. I know you think that it ain't too far. But I hear a call of a